This interview is sponsored by Walker Corporate Law. Do you need a lawyer? That's not the local guy who doesn't really get startups, not the really expensive guys who want a piece of your business, the one who really understands the startup community and is there to help you? If you do, go to Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. It's also sponsored by Grasshopper. Do you need a phone number where your customers can dial in, press 1 to go to sales, press 2 to go to customer service, etc., and maybe even all those numbers actually lead to your cell phone, but it makes you look big? Do you need that kind of feature and so many others? Go to grasshopper.com. All right, let's get started. Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I am the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart, and home of entrepreneurs who build phenomenal things. And that's why I'm especially excited to have today's entrepreneur back on. In this interview, I want to find out how you scale a company. How do you take a company that's a startup and scale it up into a big business that actually can grow without you? Last time he was here, Khalis Taid, who is the co-founder of Envato, talked about how he bootstrapped his idea, where he came up with his ideas for businesses. He actually talked about the notebook that he came up with them in. Today, I want to have a conversation about how you scale it beyond what you can do on your own. His sites include marketplaces like Theme Forest, where last time he was on, I talked about how I bought a theme for a landing page for only $8. His business also includes educational sites like Tuts Plus and freelance service marketplaces anchored by MicroLancer, where for something like $100, you could have someone design a book cover for you, or for, I think, $150, someone could design a landing page for you. How did I do with that, Khalis? This empire that's so diversified. How did I do explaining it?
That was spot on. I'm now going to use that sound clip for all our promotional materials.
Well, thank you. It's not easy describing this whole thing, and I can't imagine how tough it is to describe it to people who you want to manage it and to organize it all. So let's talk about the challenge. Most people would look at you, Khalis, and say, hey, last time, this was about 2 years ago, the guy was running a multi-million dollar business. Everything flows well when you get to the multi-million dollar business stage, but you're wincing. There was an opportunity that you missed because everything does not go well. What happened?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think, first of all, yes, there's a lot to be thankful for, so I don't want to sound like, crying in my milk or anything, but there is a lot of pain, I guess, as well. A couple of years ago when we spoke, we'd gotten to a point where we were getting traction with our products, and we had a bit of a disparate group of products, but we weren't that large, and we weren't that well staffed, I suppose you could say. So I think at the time I had almost 20 people directly reporting to me, which is kind of painful in the sense that you need to give everybody attention. You can't just like ignore a bunch of people. And there's stuff coming at you from all sides. And because of the approach we've taken at Envato, where we had multiple products, it also meant that your attention was kind of drawn to different places. And like where our marketplaces, which is the largest piece of the business, tended to take up a lot of mind shares, and then that combined with 20 people meant that some of the other parts of the business were being left behind a little bit. And I particularly find Tuts Plus, which at that time, so Tuts Plus it's half of it's free. It's like free tutorials we publish, but then there's a piece which is the subscription product. So that's where we actually make a lot of the revenue.
What kind of tutorials are on there?
So it'll be anything to do with design, development, audio production. We even have some stuff about craft, like knitting, and although that's more recent. So we teach all kinds of stuff, and our mission in this space is just really to teach.
Teaching stuff for free, but if people want to go a level deeper, they can sign up for premium, where for a monthly fee they could take courses and they're video based. And I think I see here the latest course that was published is Object Oriented Design and Refactoring Patterns in Ruby. That's the kind of course that you're offering.
Yeah. So they're pretty high tech. And at that time, so 2 years ago, it already had a subscription and it was generating almost $1 million a year in revenue, which is fairly significant. But the product was like the worst thing you can possibly imagine. I'd wake up and be amazed people were willing to pay for this.
Right. What made it so bad? And it still did $1 million a year almost.
I think it was doing $1 million a year in revenue because the space of online education, as you know, is like super hot, and there's a lot of interest in that space. And I think we happened to have a product out there early on, which was tied to a really big network. So it just naturally got a bit of conversions and traction, and it had some value in it. Don't get me wrong; it wasn't like the content had value, but the product itself, the actual mechanics of the site, were super poorly made
Give me an
in order to
example.
get. So to get content, instead of viewing it on the page, we would make you download a zip file, and then you'd have to open it on
I
your computer.
see.
There was no search. It was like super hard to find this. You literally have to just page through page after page to find something you'd seen last week.
And you still got to almost $1 million in sales. And
Yeah.
anyone who wants to see how you got there, in the previous interview, we went step by step through how you got there. You didn't allow me to talk about the revenues publicly, but you were doing well. So, oh, here's something that I want you to talk about before we continue. Do you remember why you charged $9 as opposed to $7 for a monthly membership on TutsPlus.com?
So we had another product, a jump board, which was $7, it was kind of hard to differentiate subscriptions in PayPal if they were the same price, so I made them two different prices. That was the main reason.
So this is the kind of issue that you were a growing business, but the operation wasn't keeping up with the growth. And frankly, I don't want to, you're obviously not here to cry about that, but I do want to point out that for a lot of people, the business gets really big, they can't control it, things fall apart, and they think that it's the marketplace that changed. They think that it's a bigger competitor that came in, and that's part of it. They think it's all these outside sources, but they don't realize that the root cause is they never were able to take this business and make it professional, like a real growing business. So you described a few problems. People are coming to you. You had to, you, your accounting system was at the point where you had to charge $9 for one product, seven for another, just so you can keep track of where the money was coming from. And people had to download zip files in order to watch them. And there were all these other issues. And as a result of that, you watched, can you be open about this? I'll let you be as open as you want. You watched someone else. Yeah, you're nodding. What happened? What did you watch happen outside of your business?
It was around that time we started to realize, like we about the same time I last interviewed, we started to realize we needed to get more attention to these products. I can't just, like there's so much potential, and it needed real effort. Anyhow, so we'd started gearing up to do something, but with that many people reporting to you and that much stuff happening, everything's real slow, like achingly slow, so much slower than you ever hope it would be. And in the meantime, we watched another competitor who's a really fantastic company called Treehouse. I think at that time they were called Think Vitamin. They were also deciding to focus on this same space. They also had a smallish product, similar size, and in this around the same period, must have come to the same conclusion that hey, there's a lot of there's a lot happening in this video space. And so I suppose we were kind of neck and neck, except we didn't give it a lot of attention, and we just sort of watched them go out in front. They took a big round of funding and started hiring up. But at one point, I think they had eight times as many people assigned to the same like same sort of size product, because our revenue, Treehouse is quite public about their revenue. We could see the revenue was similar, but the amount of resources being poured in there was just so much greater. And sure enough, you could just start seeing the products pulling away, and it was just so painful to see this thing where you've got the potential, you have the pieces there. You can see a competitor coming in and just like, yoink, just take that lunch and I'll have that. And so, it's a good problem to have. These are all good problems to have, I suppose, but they're problems still in
Yeah.
some way.
And actually, if I remember right, you were ahead of them for a long time. There was no way that Ryan Carson with Think Vitamin, I shouldn't say no way, I don't believe that he was at that level where he was doing hundreds of thousands of dollars or close to you.
Yeah, look, I think we might have been a little ahead. It was a little later that they became a bit more public and about their revenue. I know when they launched Treehouse, we were pretty much neck and neck, and
I see.
within 6 months to a year, they were out in front. And I don't know, before that, I mean, Ryan Carson's fantastic, and his product's great, so they may have been a bit further ahead than I realized. I like to tell myself we were in there.
Okay, so this is a problem that you got under control right now. I want to understand how you went from where you were to where you are today. And you are today right now with three different divisions in the business, the ones that I described at the top: marketplaces, education, and freelance services. Each division has its own head. Each division is organized. You said at the top of this, before we started the interview, when you and I were just chatting, you now had an HR person, you have the whole operation in order. That does not happen overnight. What is the first thing that you do when you say, okay, it's time to bring order to this business? What's the first thing?
I guess the biggest thing was just realizing that we actually started needing to be, look, I guess as an entrepreneur with no real background in companies, I never really worked anywhere else. The first few years, my focus was entirely on making products and getting them out there and like getting some money in the door, which I highly recommend is a good focus for any entrepreneur. But it was a few years in that I suddenly realized that's only going to get you so far. And then it's almost like I needed to realize that our focus had to shift internally a little bit and start being about company building. Like we needed to build up an organization and structure that could then support those products. Otherwise, we were going to keep hitting problems like this one we're having with Test Premium, where we just, you know, the will was there, the foundations were there, but there was just
opportunity is there.
Opportunity, yes. And it's so painful as an entrepreneur. I think everybody listening will understand how painful it is watching an opportunity going away when you know you could do it. So I think the realization was that we needed to put a lot of effort into company building. And then after that, it was a matter of figuring out, like, what's the right structure? How is this going to look? And it, I guess one thing I learned early on is that, two things. One, that most company structures kind of look similar, actually, in the end. There's always, I mean, not everyone, like I'm sure Valve or whatever, like no management, maybe there's those companies, but most companies tend to come out with a finance department, a legal department. That said, the structure needs to fit you and your strengths and what you're pursuing and that company's goals and what have you. So in our case, it was realizing that we would need HR and we would need somebody looking after legal, and it wasn't enough just to be outsourcing to a legal company anymore or to a contractor for.
Do you wait till your costs are so big, your legal costs are so big that you say it's time to bring someone inside? That is what you did.
Yeah, I think for us, especially because on our marketplaces, it looks like we're transacting files, but actually we transact in licenses, so intellectual property. And I think being a digital business, global, our legal requirements were strong enough that actually that was one of the first people we brought in was a general counsel. Arguably, for lots of companies, you could get a bit bigger than we were. I think at the time we had 30 employees and maybe another 20 or so, 30 contractors. So it was quite small for to have your own dedicated general counsel. And she's quite a heavy hitter IP lawyer.
Because when a designer posts his design on ThemeForest, he is giving you not exclusive rights, but he's giving you some rights to resell it. And he's giving your buyer some rights, but not all rights. And that those agreements need to be, need to work internationally. How do you get someone who understands that and understands it on an international level?
Oh, yeah, it's challenging. And you have to, I guess the key was searching. As it happened, we really lucked out with our general counsel. She was the general counsel for Lonely Planet, you know, the travel guides, and did a lot of intellectual property around that because at the end of the day, they have material and content
there. Is it a headline?
That was a job ad. We put out a job ad, and the most amazing luck happened, and this fantastic woman walked in the door. But other times, we've used headhunting firms. We interview many, many times for every role. Many interviews for each person. I've discovered as we've scaled up, since the last interview, we've quadrupled our staff. So there's close to 200 now, and bringing that many people in such short order, culture becomes really important, and you know, you're bringing in a lot of new types of people. We used to be all products people. All of a sudden, we were bringing in like more business people, and I used to think I was the business guy, and I was like, oh no, I'm not the business guy. These are the business people. They use Excel and tools like that. So yeah, culture is important to make sure that
doesn't
shift.
The first thing you did is shift. The first people you hired are people who you were spending so much money on externally anyway, you might as well bring them internally and have them be part of the company, reduce your costs. Do you reduce your costs at that point?
Yeah, look, I don't know if it reduced our costs, but it certainly reduced the headache. So sometimes when you're doing stuff externally, you kind of think to yourself, this is all just getting done. But the reality is you still have to manage that stuff. And if you're using multiple different external people, you're kind of trying to skill them up on your particular business. Like when you've got an online global internet company, it's really different to what most lawyers, at least here in Melbourne, might be used to dealing with. So you need to constantly be explaining what you're doing and teaching them. Having someone in-house means that they're
They get it.
really dedicated to understand the business. And so we started with that side of things, like the HR, legal, finance, bringing in some roles for things that I and the other founders just didn't naturally know how to do. That seemed logical. Like let's get experts in for things we're really not very good at. And then from there, the next focus was about the management for the different business units. So as you mentioned, we've now got three business units. And for me, especially in the last maybe 12 months or so, probably the biggest innovation for the businesses has been bringing in a general manager for each one. So finding someone who's kind of the little mini CEO almost of that unit. They own that business. They have their own product team. They have their own tech person,
Their
their
own
own user.
income statement too.
Yeah, that's right. So they manage their own income statement. We call them profit and loss statements here, P&Ls. So they have
Most
their
people
own
call them
P&L
that
they
actually.
manage.
But let me ask you this. It seems like a natural to break up your business into these three departments, but I don't know that it's only I don't know if it seems like a natural because we're looking at it with 2020 hindsight or if it's just the natural way to do things. Because I can imagine someone else saying, I have all these different kinds of products. I don't know, you had dozens of sites, right? Dozens of products, yeah. And with dozens of products, you could cut it up in so many different ways. Or what you could say is, we are not going to break this business down by product. We're going to break this business down by function. And someone will be responsible for educational material, and that will go on different sites. Someone will be responsible for handling the membership software, and that will go on all our sites. Why didn't you decide to do it that way? How did you come to the conclusion that you need to organize it by these three products?
That's actually an interesting question. So I've always been mildly opposed to functional organization just because I guess I think like what would I want to manage? And for me, being an entrepreneur, I like the idea of managing a small business. So I was kind of thinking if we could build small teams running each business, and it's like a really holistic team, so they have all the pieces for that business, they'll be closer to the ground, closer to the customer, closer to that product and getting what that customer or community's needs are. So for me, I suppose I was thinking, well, what would I want to be hired for? And then like working backwards. But yeah, it's an interesting idea. You do always wonder, like, would we be more super organized if we'd gone with a different like organization structure? At the end of the day, I liked the idea that if we could figure out how to have businesses within the company, each one with a business leader, that we could, in theory, just keep making businesses, which, as you know from my last interview, I love the idea of. So we've now got three, and I guess I'm already starting to think, oh, well, what's the fourth going to be? And
But
maybe
now
I'll run
the
out a
benefit
little while.
is you get to still create a fourth business within Envato and have it be its own organization. And if it doesn't work out, it's that the rest of the business isn't as impacted. And so it's
Exactly.
because you wanted to get what feels most comfortable for you, what you feel most comfortable managing, what's more familiar to you. I got it. And the advantages to this are, tell me if I'm wrong. One of the advantages is that they all get to compete with each other. They get to learn from each other and share resources, but they also get to see who's growing faster. Is that right?
Yeah, look, I think you have to be careful with competition that you don't let it become like I think there's healthy competition and then there's like we're not helping you. You stay over in your corner. So I think we have a mild level of healthy competition. They're fairly cooperative and it helps that, for example, Tuts is quite a different business than marketplaces. So it's not they're not at each other's heads or anything, or stealing community members or
I
anything like
see.
that. But at the same time, yeah, there's a little bit of competition. They get to share resources. They get to cross-promote each other, help each other out. It means there's like three peers in the sense that there's three general managers, and they can compare notes. And hopefully there'll be a fourth at some point, and the three can then support that one to get off the ground faster. I don't know if it works for every business. So far, it seems to be working for us. And today I only have 4 direct reports, which is nice. So that is dramatically down from the 20.
With 3 heads of the departments, of the business units, and what's the 4th one?
A COO. So the COO then heads up finance, legal, HR, all the sort of shared services, business intelligence, and what have you.
I see.
So that structure seems to be working. I get the sense that structures change as you get bigger, and there's I've even gotten the sense that maybe there's a pendulum effect between that sort of functional management and then product management, that there's some level of you kind of go, yeah, we're all going to be product focused, and then actually there's all these efficiencies we could get if we went back to sort of more functional. But I like the way we are.
So the first thing you said was, I'm going to lay out what the finished product looks like. The finished product is a business that has many businesses underneath it and shared resources and shared people, like HR would be shared, finance department and the lawyers would be shared. That's the vision that you had. Now it's time to start breaking things up, right? Where I'm imagining you had to say, I got to pick 3 guys to lead it. I say guys, but I mean guys or women. I need to pick 3 people to lead it. And then I need to start divvying up the designers. I need to start moving the developers around. Is that the next step, or is there something else? It is.
So we had people sort of, so there were people being shared across products, but usually there was a majority focus for each person. And so we kind of assigned them into those groups. Over time, like at first we continued sort of sharing resources actually between the units. Like I'm a big believer that you get the form first, so you figure out what it's kind of supposed to look like, and then the function follows. So in this case, we started splitting up the teams into this, like saying, you're the marketplace team, but oh yeah, by the way, you still do work for this team, you still do work for that team, you still do this and this and this, and it was kind of hazy at first. But then over time, just naturally, those boundaries got a bit stronger. The general manager, actually 2 of the general managers are women, so they are actually gals rather than guys. But
I figure that, you know what, for some reason, guys is the word that I always use. And lately, maybe it's because I live in California now, dudes. I call everyone dudes. So how did you find the 3 people who are going to run it, dude?
So the 3 people, we hired, promoted from internal. So he's a fantastic sort of product background, but also tech operations. He runs Tuts. Another for the marketplaces, which is the largest group, we hired. She was the marketing director for Seek, which is like a global jobs company. It's actually bigger than Monster in company valuation, but they own like a big Chinese job site and whatnot. Then she had a management consulting background. So we wanted someone, management consultants, from what I've come to learn, are fantastic at going into businesses, understanding them, having a really holistic sort of view of them. And having said that, someone who's only been management consulting, I'd worry maybe, you know, jumping over, have they been on the product side. So it was good that she'd also been in an actual business for some years. And then the 3rd role for Microlancer, because it was a brand new product, the GM is from a very heavy innovation products background. So she was very good at starting new things, getting them up to a certain size. So for each role, we kind of look for a different type of person. 2 came from outside, 1 we hired from, 1 we promoted from inside.
What's the big challenge in hiring for this? What's the gotcha that someone who doesn't watch this interview is possibly going to fall for?
So for the marketplaces, which is the big engine of the
business.
No,
for picking people who are going to run it. There's got to be some issue that I want us to be prepared for.
Well, I guess so. In picking the one for the largest part of the business, in the interviews, when I interviewed various people, I'd get, like, to get someone who was able to run a business like that, a lot of the candidates that I met, I had the sense that they were a bit like, all right, step aside, son. The cavalry's arrived.
I see. Hey, you just lucked into this, and you're a guy who doesn't know business. We're going to really be the business people and handle it. I see.
Exactly. So, like, and you never know. Maybe they were right. I don't know. But it's a bit hard to manage a person who's like, hey, look, you know, I was the CEO of a listed company, and now I'm going to come in here and be a general manager. But just so we're both clear, you know, I could do your job.
See?
That's a bit challenging. You want someone, in my opinion, you want someone who has humility and like a sort of learning posture, that they're trying to, they feel they've got a lot to bring, but also a lot to take in. So that was a key challenge. I think also cultural fit, I suppose, you know, for the first time in bringing general managers. So as I said, I used to have like half the company was reporting to me. And then we suddenly scaled up, lots of new people, and now we're bringing in like extra layer of management and they're reporting to these people. That was a massive transition. Like, I think for a lot of the staff, they're a bit like, you know, it's all changing. It's not like it used to be. Who's
now
this giant?
I can't talk to you. You're my friend. We've had drinks forever. Can I just tell you what I need to do? No, go and talk to the guy. How do you make that transition without being a jerk?
Yeah, so that was hard. And I think some of it was just time, like letting time pass. Some of it was hiring people who are so fantastic, they quickly, like everyone quickly realized, wow, this person's going to deliver massive value to our team.
So what was I doing following that other amateur? Here is the guy who I see.
Thank God he stepped aside.
I see the issue. What do you say to somebody who comes to you and says, Collis, I know what needs to be done. You and I have talked. Now you've created this artificial barrier between us. Come on, let me just clear the way here.
So look, I guess I always made sure that people realized my door is open. I would still, like, I would meet every new person and take them out for a coffee and chat to them about the company and make sure they felt like there was some level of direct line, even as we're growing and there might be multiple layers of management between me and that person. I think that helped. And I'd always kind of say, look, you know, we're happy to chat and we'll just grab the other person in and we'll have a, you know, a three-person chat. And I think over time, then it's naturally, you know, as they've come to have relationships with those general managers. So I think, to be honest, I think a lot of it is time and being conscious that this is a cultural problem going on. We also have to really invest in internal communication. So for the first time, it wasn't good enough to have, like, you know, when you're small, you're kind of all just around a bunch of desks and people just hear stuff and you kind of know what's going on. All of a sudden, we were over multiple levels of an office, and there were people who didn't know who those people were and had no idea what was happening. So we instituted all-hands meetings and then brought in an intranet and started having a lot more planned company social things. Yeah, it was kind of weird, actually, realizing that you needed to invest in just making sure that everyone knew what we're all doing, that we're all walking in the same direction.
That's an even bigger problem for companies that aren't all in the same, where everyone isn't all in the same place. In fact, you mentioned Ryan Carson. I did an interview with him about how he got to, and he announced on in that Mixergy interview, how he got to $3 million in revenue for Treehouse. Yes. But I also asked him to come back and teach a course for Mixergy Premium, where he talked about how he allows, how he enables people to talk to each other, how he keeps a company where everyone is working from a different part of the world. How does it keep them united? And partially, I did that because I needed to know how to do it. It's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah. So we actually have 80 remote staff. So there's 100 people here in Melbourne, and then there's 80 spread around the world. So we had a similar problem. We had that problem, and like, how do you keep them all feeling connected? But also, how do you stop them from feeling disconnected when there's this hub of activity in Melbourne with like 100 people, they're all next to each other and it's
how
a lot faster.
How do you keep them all feeling connected and not feeling like, ah, that's just some remote thing that I send my work to and money comes out of remotely?
Yeah, it's hard. I think we could do a lot better job, frankly. So keep that in mind. We started investing lots in video. So we record all of our old hands meetings. There's a guy there with a big video camera making sure it goes live on the internet within a couple of days. The internet itself helps, Yammer, like lots of sort of social tools online. We actually have an internal communications officer who's this fantastic woman whose sole job is to make sure that everyone's kind of connected. And so, for example, next week is, actually I shouldn't say what's happening next week because they haven't seen it, but a few weeks ago we had a big celebration in the office because we'd passed a big milestone. We made sure we were sending out these little candies with Envato logos and postcards, handwritten postcards out to all the remote people. So they still felt like they were kind of part of things. I think we had a a remote social event where they all played letterpress, like a letterpress tournament for remote people. So I think just trying to create that sort of vibe.
You mean letterpress the game, the iPhone game?
Letterpress the game, yes.
So they all play against each other, and that feels like, all right, if I played and beat you or you beat me, I at least get to know you, and you're another person. Another name on the internet. You're a person who I played and gotten to know.
Exactly. Something beyond just a work colleague or a name. A year ago, we were a little bit smaller a year ago, but we're still sizable. We also had a big company meetup. So we all went to Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. I took 50 staff or so. So there's like 30 people from Melbourne. We all went. And then 25 or so of the remote people, some of their families and partners all came along. We spent 2 weeks in KL working in a hotel. So that kind of helped as well. At that time,
that?
When we were.
Did you pay for them to all come?
Well, we're pretty, you know, we're bootstrapped, so we're pretty good at finding cheap ways to do things. And so later I got an events company and I told them how much we spent, and they were kind of shocked at how little it was. It was still awesome. We picked a place like KL where the flights are expensive in, but then once you're there, you can stay for ages, and the food's really cheap, and the accommodation's really cheap. And but yeah, it was a lot, but I think it's an investment in people. You know, you think about like how much you spend on salaries and whatnot. For me, this was an investment in culture. We knew we were hiring heaps of people, and we knew we were going to be bringing in a lot of people from a lot of different places. So it was important to get everyone together and have a bit of a what is Envato? What's this company? And so it was during that meetup we established some of the company values, set out goals for the company, just sort of talked about what it all was about, and of course ate an atrocious amount of food. If you've ever been to Malaysia, you'll know it's all about food there. So put down a few kilos.
You had 200 or so people at the company. Did you say only these 50 can come, or did you open it up to everyone?
So at that time, this is a year ago, so there was about half that. There was maybe 80 or 90, and we 50-something came. That was mostly, there was some people who were just like, look, we, I got family obligations or what.
I can't just come to Kuala. But you opened it up to everyone.
Everyone, yeah. As long as you've been with us for more than a few months, which also ruled out a few people.
Okay, and so now we're getting to something that you kept saying over and over, and I didn't stop to dive into. I almost brushed it aside, but trust me, I wrote it down so I can come back to it. Culture. You keep saying, I keep going to software, you keep telling me culture is important. I keep asking you about specific hiring, you say culture. So it seems like at this in-person meeting is where you started to formalize the culture that you wanted for the company.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think there had been a culture in the company already. I think it was at this point that we realized it probably wasn't enough to just assume it, if that makes sense, and assume we were going to keep adding it. I also have the belief that culture is infected into other people. So, it starts with the founders and the first hires you bring in, the choices you make about who you hire, the choices about, you know, how you promote, those things all spread the culture of the company. And as it grows, those people are then hiring other people and it just keeps spreading. So at that point when we knew we were likely to massively ramp up in how many staff there were, it was really important to make sure we all kind of stopped and went, well, what actually do we value in this company? What are we actually doing? What are we working towards? And even just making sure everyone had kind of met each other and had a sense of what the whole vibe of the place was.
How did you build the culture before this intentional meeting? And I want to ask you in a moment about what you did. I wrote down that you said you wrote down the values at this meeting and so on. I want to understand what you did there. But what happened with the culture up until that point?
So I guess a lot of it was kind of organic in the sense that, as I say, the people you hire, for example, that's probably the key place where you are spreading culture. When you hire people, you're deliberately making a choice about the kind of person who's going to be working at the company and what their values are. At the end of the day, it's very hard to give values to somebody. So, you know, if your value is about teamwork and you hire some super maverick guy, you can keep telling them teamwork all day long, but, you know, if they don't just genuinely share that value, it's always going to be a little bit of a put on at some
but
level.
But you know what, so Carlos, most people, including me, I have to admit, don't know what their culture is. And so if they're facing someone and it doesn't jive with them. They say it doesn't jive, but I can't identify why it doesn't jive. What I can identify is this guy has the background that we need. This guy has the ability. He has the willingness. She is here. She knows what she's doing. We better hire her. So unless you're clear on it, you bend the rules, or other people can't
I guess, do it. So the things I used to always look for and I still look for are people I like. I guess maybe this is the luxury of being a founder. I'm like, I want to work with people I like. Friendliness is it's really important to me that the company is a very friendly place where it's not too much trouble to help somebody else out. That they're smart. I take smart over experienced. I'd want someone who's going to be really sharp, pick things up with a kind of, I don't mind doing different types of things, willing to grow with the company. So I guess there are things, and I'm sure that most people, maybe it's just subconsciously, would have a list of things they kind of like to see in a person. Then there's like all the experience and whatnot. I guess to me, the important thing is you need to be willing to throw out a fantastic opportunity to hire someone when they don't meet those cultural things. And sometimes that's really painful. You're like, oh, this person could solve so many problems.
Right.
And their resume is beautiful, but they're just a bit unfriendly, but it'll be fine. We'll friendly them up. But it doesn't work that way, I think.
I've made that mistake. And then you end up with people who cause trouble forever, and you're more in debt to them, or you're deeper in their world and you can't get out. There's one person forever. We were supposed to let him go. The longer we waited, the harder it was, because he knew everything. He knew what, he knew his job, and no one else did, because he's unfriendly.
Often you grow to like a person and have a bond with them. You don't just want to throw somebody out or anything. And so it's much better to at the gate be like discerning about like these are the things that are important to us. It definitely helps if you've mapped out those things early on. I suppose my barometer was just, do I like this person? Do they seem like a person I want to spend time with? Because you are spending a lot of time with them, in the office. You spend a lot of time finding people to have a relationship with. So it makes sense you should spend a lot of time with the guy you're going to sit next to for 8 hours a day, making sure that's the right kind of person for your company.
So then you're in Kuala Lumpur, and it's time to formalize this so that other people know who belongs in the company, how we work at the company, what we do at the company. It was a pretty formal process, or organized and thought out. It didn't just happen with people sitting on beanbags saying, oh, what's our culture? So it sounds like what you did was you said, let's list our values first. Is that where you started?
So the values process took 2 years, actually. The thing I was most terrified of was going, our values are, integrity, respect, and then turning out to be Enron somehow, where the values were dissonant from the actual organization. So it started off with, I did a draft, actually, long before we went. I was like, I think these are the things that are important. And then I met with, person after person in the organization, just saying, running them past them. And so we got to kind of what I would call a working draft by the time we went to KL. When we got there, then we had a big session with everybody where we had them up on the, went through them on the screen, discussed each one in detail, and then had a big open discussion. We were little enough to actually have a discussion. There was 50 people in the room. It was a more full-on discussion than I'd imagined. There were tears and everything. So that was good in the sense that it really went there.
When you talked about what your values were, there were tears?
Yeah, there was there were places where we hadn't done a good job of. So I guess the most important thing with values is that you live up to them, right? And so there were times where, it turned out there was a group of the remote staff who were constantly fearful for their jobs because they were so far away. They're like, I don't know, I don't get much feedback.
Now one piece is going to replace me with someone local now that they don't have to have remote people to save money. So I see. And so how did that make people cry?
That's completely different to our values of, we're going to focus on people and make sure they're empowered and have the right environment. So finding something like this out was, clearly we weren't doing a good enough job. And that, I guess, prompted a lot of soul searching about, well, do we really value this thing? Since, some of our staff are constantly worried about losing their job. And if we really do, which we did, how do we bring up the the level of what we're doing. So from that meeting, then we continued working on the values, and it took me another like 9 months to finally actually roll them out. The values, I suppose, for me are the keystone of the culture, both because they encapsulate various things we hold important, but also they're supposed to be like decision-making tools.
Yeah.
To me, the bigger you get, the more times there are points in your business where you actually have to make some key decision and you need something to go back to. So for example, one of our values is about, is tell it like it is, like a sort of transparency value. So a year and a bit ago, we had a big password incident where we've been storing some of our passwords in clear text in the Tuts Premium product that I was talking about before. It was this like shoddy system we were using. We hadn't upgraded it. I'd known, I was like, you know, it'll be fine. We're building this new thing. It'll all be okay. Anyhow, it got hacked. And so all of a sudden we're faced with, I guess, a cultural values moral decision. Like, what do you do? How much do you disclose?
There was an issue where you guys were hacked, passwords were exposed. And so how does being open with each other come into play here?
I guess so for an instance like that, when you find out that some security issue's been compromised and your user's data is out there, you know, you've got a bunch of different choices, right? You can be like, everybody, you should change your passwords. Don't explain why, don't explain, you know, just a notification. And like, I'm sure you've seen some of these every now and then, like, I wonder what that's about. Or you can be like, hey, we've been hacked and you should change your passwords. Or in our case, it was, we've been hacked and it turns out we were doing something super dodgy because we were holding clear text passwords and you should change your passwords really urgently because we haven't been doing a good enough job. So that was the one we went with. We're like, well, that's, you know, we're supposed to tell it like it is. And that's the way it is. And unfortunately, we were doing something dumb. And then I guess the corollary of that was that, you know, in a company with lots of fantastic software developers, their reputation ends up on the line for something like that. You know, people were like, our devs are like a bunch of bums. What were they thinking? As it happened, the day before on NetTuts, we published a tutorial which was about how to store passwords properly. Anyway, so in a situation like that, you know, I guess it was important to make sure people understood, actually, this specific request to not fix it had come from me. It wasn't like it was, you know, some guy off somewhere who made a dumb decision. It was like, no, the CEO called this one, and it was a stupid call. So I guess our value came into play in the sense that it was a clear-cut decision that we should tell everybody. We should make it clear that this wasn't some scapegoat guy that we're now going to get rid of. It was like a foolish decision. We then, you know, refunded people. We subscriptions dropped right off. We gave out 3 months of this and that, and I mean, there was various things you do after that. But
how much money did you lose because of that?
I'd say just under $1 million.
Under $1 million.
Yeah, it was about.
And that's
this.
Because you weren't taking payment from people for the next 3 months. And because people left you as a result of this.
Exactly.
And other people might have been nervous about signing up, but does that even count into these figures?
So look, I think about $500,000 was the refunds and the actual payouts. Then the drop-offs, there was another couple hundred thousand. And then probably there's even more, as you say, in terms of like brand reputation, what it says about you as a company. Yeah, it was pretty bad. It's definitely one of the worst things that's happened in the company's history. I remember sitting there late at night being like, oh man, what a, you know, I've ruined this product unit. I totally called it wrong. We've come back from there. You know, we did manage.
You feel alone in those situations as a guy who doesn't have investors who have money at stake and are therefore have a real interest to buck you up and to help you out. You don't have that.
I guess, well, we've got the team. the team is very supportive.
I see.
So the management team and as you might remember, some of my family works with me, so that's always nice. My wife was like, it's okay. It's going to be all right.
What about this? I know that in a few minutes you have to go because you have a board meeting. What kind of board do you have as a bootstrapper?
it's probably a slightly less formal board. So it's actually my board is my wife, My big brother, my dad, I can't remember if I told you last time, but we mentioned to him, it's my dad who joined the business, and my best friend. So that's pretty cool. Our finance director and general counsel also come along. So the general counsel is the company secretary and running through finances. The board for a long time was very informal, actually. And this is another example of bringing in the form and then letting the function follow. So we decided, look, we're going to meet every month as a board. We all went and did company director training, which we have here in Australia. I assume it's similar things everywhere, learning about the responsibilities and what you're supposed to do. And then over time, just started adding more and more formality to it. And now it's becoming a more and more useful thing. It, I guess, is a chance to step away from the business and think a bit more holistically and big picture. And we've also had a couple of the founders have sort of stepped back from the business a bit, so they also have a little bit more perspective.
But yeah, on board is, also.
Yeah, but we don't wear suits, and
I see
which
you're
is what
in a t-shirt.
People did at board meetings.
Here's something else. Here's something that I noticed as I reread the transcript of our previous interview.
Yeah.
This was just an offhand remark. You said, like, in our accounting, there's lots of different tabs in Excel. There are lots of different tabs in Excel if you like each one. And so you see which ones are abysmally, you know what? I shouldn't have read it literally. Basically, what you were saying to me when I said you have a lot of different businesses, you said, yeah, you should see our Excel because this spreadsheet has lots of different tabs, a tab for each one of our different products. And that way we can see which one's forming abysmally. And what I registered as I reread that is he's using Excel to run his business. That is so painful. So you have to go from Excel to formal accounting software that it takes into account that you have all these different people in the company. That is not something that you want to go and evaluate the software for. It's not something you want to implement. It's not something you want to get wrong and then correct and so on. But you can't also lay out the rules for someone else to do it. So at that stage of management, when a new thing needs to come on board, how do you get someone to do it the way that you need it for the company? How do you manage that?
I guess for something like this transition to an accounting software package, it was really, although we're actually depressingly looking for another one yet again, I've come to the conclusion accounting software packages, future business, they're not great, some of them. We hired a finance director, and I think for me, something like this, like at the end of the day, I just don't know that much about accounting software, right? How effective am I really going to be? And so it came down to hiring the right finance director and then bringing in the right IT support and figuring out how it was going to connect to our various parts of the company. We made some headway. We got something which is better than what we used to use. Still not where it needs to be, though. I think the reality is a lot of accounting packages out there are not, a lot of them are constructed around other types of businesses. So, for example, integrating with PayPal and the very hazy world of PayPal reporting is really complicated and turns out to be very difficult. With products like our marketplaces, they almost have an entire accounting system inside them as well. And reconciling these things is really challenging.
So how do you get someone to find the right kind of software? Depending on what you're looking for, the software that they pick is different, right?
Yeah.
So how do you explain what you want and then get it? Or even just how do you send someone out into the world to find that?
Yeah, look, so it took months. We the last round, we spent 6 months and ended up with no software. Just continued on with our old slightly hinky-dink package. Just because, I guess, yeah, you have to map out the requirements. The requirements are quite complicated. There's also different architectural ways you can set it up. So at our most recent stab at this whole thing of finding a new ERP system, and we've hired two consulting companies to help us map out the possible architecture we could possibly use. We've asked a lot of, like, so I reached out to other entrepreneurs. I contacted the CEO of Atlassian and was like, hey, I'm an Australian as well. Want to meet up? And then just was like, so what do you guys do? And I guess drawing on networks, trying to figure out what other people are doing and how they've solved similar problems, I think that sort of helps. But having said all that, we haven't solved this problem, so I don't know if I should give any advice on this.
There is a question of how do you give directions. When you're starting out, the way to give directions is to say, here is step-by-step exactly what I want. Very similar to what Tim Ferriss does for his outsourcers. Very explicit, and they do it, and they mostly get it right. He even says, when you pass this on to someone else, I think he suggested reading a book about letting bad things happen, because you have to expect they're not going to do it exactly like you, even when you laid out like that. But that's the first step. The next step is what? It's to give people some guidance. To say, this is what we stand for. Here are the things we're looking for in the solution. Go to town, but come back to me and tell me what you. Actually, I don't know. You tell me. What is that?
I think context is the key. Like at some level, you want to, especially as you get more and more senior people, you want to give them all the context they need to be able to make the decision as if they're the owner of this problem. There's a famous TED speaker, Dan Pink, who speaks about motivation for staff and what motivates people is mastery, autonomy, and purpose. Is his thesis. So mastery, you know, they want to master their craft, and autonomy, which is, I guess, the key one for this point, is wanting to have some level of ownership over what they're doing. I think good people will make good decisions if you give them the context, the information around the decision. So this is how the business works. These are the things that are important. These are how we make decisions. Now you figure out what's best for this. At the end of the day,
this is how we make decisions. Is that a formal thing, or is that?
These are our values, or these are our. This is like. I guess, sometimes there'll be some formal aspects. So, for example, if we business case things for a particular type of product decision, you might say, oh, this is a kind of business case we might do. And then some of it is, as I was mentioning before, values of like, this is your compass for making a certain type of decision.
We value privacy. So if there's a better solution in the cloud, no, our value is privacy. So you go to the slightly worse solution, but one that's on our servers.
Yeah, that's a great example. Yeah, so that I think giving the person all the tools to make those decisions. Like at the most simplest level, the example you gave is like almost down to like step-by-step directions is the simplest version of giving them the tools to make whatever decisions they need to make. But as you get more and more people and more senior people, you want to give them less and less specifics, less and less prescription, and more and more the things around it. And I just always think about like, what would I want? I inherently don't like bosses and don't like too much structure. I just like people giving me the headlines, and then I'll figure out the best way I know how to do it. So I think that works a more delegative rather than directive approach.
What's your current annual revenues?
Well, last time I think I told you 1 million. I've just given the card away about that because I said Touch Premium was making 1 million all by itself. Today we say more than 10 million. But beyond that, we don't really see.
I was doing quick math here to see where you were, and I could tell it's at least 10 million. Last time, actually, I don't think you allowed me to say it publicly. You said we are private. And I always say to guests, I think I might have said that even to you before we started today. I'm going to push for questions. You feel comfortable revealing what you want, but I don't want you to ever feel like you have to. Over $10 million dollars for a guy who's basically an artist. It's amazing that you're able to organize things the way that you are, that you're able to, frankly, this isn't an insult to you. It's the way the world works. Businesses have a hard time hanging on when they grow as much as you do. They have a hard time growing to this size, and they have a hard time hanging on to that growth. And it's amazing what you've done. It's an inspiration to watch you build up this business.
Thank you. It's been super hard, it turns out.
Why do you want to do an interview here on Mixergy? You and I were chatting via email, and you said, "Hey, maybe it's time for me to come back." We got everything you need. What do you need an interview on Mixergy for?
Look, I guess Voto were big believers in education and teaching and like sharing experiences. And you're just saying like, how do you, when you don't know very much about these kinds of things, how do you grow a business like that? And I think it's just by learning from others, observing. I always found job interviews were a really good place to learn. So every time we interview people for something, like let's say we're hiring HR director, every candidate who comes in, I try to learn more about HR, so that by the time we hire someone, I'm like, hey, I have a vague working knowledge of this field. And I think the same with entrepreneurship. You just like learn as much as you can from everyone around you. The reality is each person's path is a little bit different, but you just take a little hodgepodge of things from different people. And I guess for me, coming on Mixergy is hopefully sharing that next bit, some stuff I wish someone had told me.
Well, there it is, guys. Thank you all for watching this interview. I hope the next time we do this interview that Collis's revenues will be $100 million, or he'll be telling me more than $100 million. We'll see. Actually, beyond that, beyond the revenue, it's just it's inspiring to watch you build up this business. It's inspiring to watch the individual products develop and to see the creativity that keeps coming out. I don't think last time we did this interview, I'm looking here at the list of products, MicroLancer was not on my list.
3 months old.
You just keep developing these businesses, high quality companies, and it's cool to watch them develop. Thank you for doing this interview. Thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, guys.